Now, I don't care what the weatherman says. When the weatherman says it's raining, you never hear me complaining. I'm certain the sun will shine. I don't care how the weather vane points. When the weather vane points to gloomy, it's got to be sunny to me. When your eyes look into mine, oh jeepers, creepers.
Well, jeepers creepers indeed, and as you can hear, Louis Armstrong has a very sunny attitude to gloomy weather forecasts. He simply dismisses them. But to everyone from flight crews to my fellow farmers, weather forecasts are crucial. And in my lifetime, I've seen them grow increasingly and indeed remarkably accurate, but it wasn't always thus. My first guest tonight will tell us that the sky was God's wilderness, a place apart, an impenetrable barrier between his divine kingdom and the tainted underworld below. And there's a marvellous story how people, Christians, who would ring church bells when storms approached as a way of signalling their piety, hoping to drive the weather away. We'll be talking to Peter Moore shortly, but first I have to predict calm weather for my second guest, which, astonishingly, is Gerard Henderson, the polarising provocateur and pundit. He's no friend of this program or its presenter, but he will be here to discuss his mentor, the even more provocative and polarising B.A. Santa Maria. Oh, and I must remember to ask Gerard to repeat his old assertion that General Franco wasn't a fascist. But let me repeat the weather forecast in that that part of the program all will be cordial and calm, as is the tradition of the Little Wireless program. None of the stormy weather that fascinated Ben Franklin, who in the, the 1740s, conducted that famous experiment with a kite and a key, and out of which came one of the first products, consumer products, that derived directly from scientific research. He was able to offer the churches and the farmers of America lightning rods. Now, this is important because barns were constantly being hit by lightning and burning to the ground, as were churches. So here, all of a sudden, is a product to defend them. But many of the churches felt it was impious to whack the things on their buildings, and so while the secular buildings survived, the sacred continued to incinerate. And I've always found that a very, very amusing story. Now, the idea of forecasting the weather, which we see as so ordinary, is in fact a remarkably recent development, and that's why Peter Moore is with us tonight. Peter, I didn't realise that even the word forecast is a relatively recent coinage for weather.
That's right. Well, first of all, good evening. It's good to speak to you, and you're completely right. The word forecast, I mean, we're so used to weather forecasts and the idea of forecasting that it's sometimes difficult to think of a time before they existed, because they've just become, you know, such an ingrained part of everyday life. But the word forecast was coined by an admiral in the British Navy called Robert Fitzroy, and in the 1860s he began to use this word for the first time to describe his new practice of predicting the weather, because he wanted a new term which was not encumbered by all the old baggage of the past. Because people before would talk about, they've talked about predictions, they'd talked about prognostications. So what Fitzroy was doing was different. He wanted to do something which was a combination of science, the new weather science of the 19th century, which was exciting and built on the work of Franklin, and observation, which he was very keen on as well. And he came up with this term, forecast.
Peter is with us because he's written an extraordinarily interesting book called The Weather Experiment, The Pioneers Who Sought to See the Future. He's joining us now from our London studio. And you start the story off in the early 19th century. There'd been many advances in science by that time, yet still the mechanics of the weather were mysterious.
That's pretty accurate. I mean, we think of the scientific revolution as really belonging to the 17th century. You think of figures like Newton and Harvey and Galileo and people like this. And then into the 18th century, you have Linnaeus, who's working on plants, and Werner, who's working on rocks, and Priestley, who's organising gases. And so we go through this period of a great general sorting out of nature. So things stop becoming mysterious and godlike, and they stop becoming rational and scientific. But in the year 1800, which is, you know, not too far distant to where we are today, the atmosphere remained pretty much the only part of nature, or the last part of nature, to be classified, and people wondered whether it would be classified at all. I think it was just considered a realm beyond science, and this is goes back to the religious angle that you alluded to earlier on.
In 1803, you introduce us to Luke Howard's essay on the modification of clouds. Who was Howard, and why was the essay significant?
Well, it's a good story, an instructive story, I think, actually. There's a bit of background, which I like to give with Howard, because he was a member of an intellectual philosophical society in London called the Askesian Society. And they were a small group of like-minded philosophical men who used to gather and meet once a month. And one of the requirements is they had to present a paper to each meeting, okay? And when it was your turn, if you didn't produce your paper, you had to pay a fine. So instead of paying this fine, Luke Howard came up with what I think he imagined to be quite a ludicrous idea, and this was to give names to clouds. And clouds before had just been described in poetic terms. People would talk about, you know, mare's tails, as we still do today. But there was, you know, many other descriptive terms. And if you go back into Shakespeare, there's some great terms for clouds. And people have lived with this kind of, you know, this unsettled and colourful language for a long time. And what Howard wanted to do was standardise things. And he picked Latin, which was the intellectual lingua franca of the day, and he came up with these terms which we still use today. And well, people
cirrus, cumulus, stratus, nimbus. Astonishing that they came
exactly
from this one bloke.
They all did, and I mean, at the same time, also worth pointing out, there was a Frenchman called Lamarck who came up with the same idea, and he came up with a different classification based on the shape of different vegetables. So we could, I mean, but for a very quirk of history, we might be talking about the vegetables of the sky today.
Well, tell us about Francis Beaufort.
Beaufort was a wonderful, roistering, seafaring character, lived during the Napoleonic Wars. And he had a very colourful life. He was shipwrecked in the Indian Ocean, and he went back. After that, he was assaulted, and very nearly died at sea off the coast of Spain. Went back to Ireland, worked on a new idea which is called the optical telegraph. And then he was a man who was very interested in observation, and he was very much a man of the Enlightenment. And he combined, I suppose, his time at sea with these Enlightenment ideals. And one day in 1806, he was, so this is just a couple of years after Howard had come up with the ideas for the clouds, he was a frustrated captain of a store ship in the Thames, I think he was at the time, and he wanted to come up with a nice little framework to you know, kind of classify the skies. And
well,
particularly
forgive me for interrupting, but I think it's important to realise that all British ship commanders kept a log, this was a requirement, but their accounts of weather were more poetic than specific. You know, as you point out, one captain might describe a galloping wind, someone else might call it a dashing breeze, and
or
of course, without
tempest,
specificity, there were real dangers.
Exactly, and what Beaufort realised was that, you know, all you needed was a little bit of shorthand. So he came up with this 13-point scale for, you know, defining different wind speeds, which is the start of the Beaufort scale. And he also came up with a complete set of alphabetical code, which, I mean, like kind of B would like kind of relate to a blue sky, for example. And so with this shorthand, he was able to really standardize ship's logs. And this just existed in his journal for a long time, but as he grew in influence and he became hydrographer to the British Navy, he was able to implement this. And so, yeah, this is really important because it's the start of a proper framework, standardized framework for the skies.
Let's go back to the most remarkable of all these characters, and that's Admiral Robert Fitzroy, who we would remember as being captain of the Beagle during Darwin's voyage.
Absolutely. This is Fitzroy's fate is to be remembered for his walk-on role in the evolution story. And one of the things I've tried to do in writing the weather experiment is shift the focus somewhat back onto Fitzroy in his own right. And so, of course, he was a wonderful character. He was descended from aristocracy, from a line which included prime ministers and kings and dukes and such like. And he was a real prodigy in the Navy, went to sea at 13 and was a captain of the Beagle by 23, was very influential in surveying of South America, Patagonia, Tierra del Fuego, places like this where weather was in its most boisterous and extreme and raw and dangerous, where sailors could be lost in a minute by a sudden gust or whatnot. And this was formative for Fitzroy and had a real lasting effect on him. And later in his career, I mean, a career which also I'll mention very briefly, had him the governor of New Zealand very briefly, and he was also an MP in the House of Commons. He later went on to found this department of the British government called the Meteorological Department. And this was a complete curiosity at the time, 1854. So they had this new department, the Meteorological Department. I mean, it's almost as weird to us as a department of physics or a department of chemistry would sound today. I mean, it's like, why would you have a department of the government just for a branch of the sciences? And really what Fitzroy had been told to do, his orders, were to produce wind maps. So this is a time of great expansion of the British Empire. And they wanted to produce intelligent wind maps with information from, like, kind of Beaufort's logs, these kind of things. And so you'd be able to plot intelligent routes from point A to point B. So instead of going in a straight line, you could, you know, kind of hove, like, kind of between the areas of contrary winds and things.
Can I walk back from the science for just a minute? Because I love the your account of his relationship with Darwin. Here he is, captain of the Beagle, but he's there as much to provide intellectual companionship for Charles as he is to run the ship, isn't he? And don't you say they argued a lot?
They they didn't. I mean, I think in the main they got on very well. I think that's fair to say. But they did have moments, and at this point, I suppose you've got to imagine them, two very young men, very bright and interested to discover the world. And I think of, you know, almost like astronauts in NASA today or something like this. They were going out into these places that were completely unexplored and, you know, kind of walking over the plains of Patagonia. And it's a vivid picture. I mean, Fitzroy was really into this pseudoscience called phrenology, which is pretty much forgotten.
You're not telling me phrenology is a pseudoscience. I've lived by it.
Well, I don't want to I don't want to ruin any of your own personal philosophies, but Fitzroy was mad on this. And he, I mean, there's a great quote with when he first saw Darwin, and Darwin was introduced to him in Britain when he was looking for this companion. And it was actually Beaufort who was, like, putting them together. So he was doing the matchmaking, the intellectual matchmaking. And Darwin later found out that that Fitzroy very nearly rejected him for the Beagle voyage on account of the shape of his nose, because Fitzroy didn't believe anyone with a nose like Darwin's could ever come to any good.
But he didn't run his hands over Darwin's dome.
No, I don't think he did. I think that would have been beyond the code of civility and manners of the early 19th century. But Darwin's nose ran a very, like, kind of narrow risk of having him thrown off the Beagle voyage, and how different history might have been. We never know.
You also point out that he became a bit of a star to the public, but he also had enemies who regarded him as reckless and megalomaniacal. Anyway, let's not dwell on his personality traits, because there's a lot of ground to cover on Late Night Live on RN, online and on mobile. And my guest is Peter Moore, whose book is called The Weather Experiment, The Pioneers Who Sought to See the Future. Peter, there was an event which was something of a turning point in your story, and it once again has a South Pacific connection, an Australian connection, the Royal Charter sinking.
So this was in 1859, and I described before how the 5 years earlier the Meteorological Department had been founded, and Fitzroy was in charge of it. And and Fitzroy was, had already been troubled by the loss of life at sea, you know, in storms and bad weather. And as theory had kind of progressed throughout the century, they'd come to a point where they'd understood when storms were likely to come and what path they were likely to take. Now, the Royal Charter at this point comes into the story because it was an auxiliary steam clipper. It was a beautiful example of Victorian engineering. It was a real kind of source of pride for the country, a bit like a Titanic, before the Titanic in a way. It was a great chandelier of a ship, which more than anything was brilliant because it could sail between Melbourne and Liverpool in 60 days. So this idea of the world shrinking was becoming really real. I mean, you could go 2 months, you could be Britain to Australia. So this was new stuff. And of course, there was the gold rush in Australia in the 1850s, which had lured a lot of people from, you know, from Britain who were seeking their fortune. And by 1859, I think the tide was turning, to excuse the pun, but the people were coming back to Britain, and a lot of them had made a lot of money. And the Royal Charter had set off in August 1859, and it pretty much made its passage back to Liverpool. It was going up through the Irish Sea, and it was absolutely loaded with gold. And passengers being passengers, a lot of it was secreted to kind of avoid the customs officers. So they had it hidden in shoes, in pockets, in money belts, things like this. And at this point, it sailed into a horrible storm, which later became known as the Royal Charter Gale, one of the greatest storms of the 19th century. And the captain disregarded all of the, you know, the kind of the weather wisdom of the time. And there was no way of telegraphing or communicating with the shore to find out that this was coming. So he sailed straight into this, and the ship was thrown back onto the rocks of Anglesey Island, which is just north of Wales. And it was a completely tragic story. 400 people or more died. Not one single woman or child survived.
Many drowned, as you point out, because they were weighed down by the gold in their pockets.
Which is, I know it's a kind of terrible moral conundrum for these people. I suppose they lost their reason, but they were carrying 10 years worth of work with them in their pockets. And yeah, a lot of them just drank, a lot of them jumped overboard and went straight to the bottom. And the gold was washing up on the shore for a long time afterwards.
Fitzroy can use this for momentum. Yeah. And we have some great achievements coming very rapidly afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, it became a catalytic moment. Charles Dickens went and wrote an essay called The Shipwreck about the Royal Charter. Everyone knew about it. It was something that was too big for the politicians to ignore. They couldn't just say it was another shipwreck. And within a year, Fitzroy had been given, authorization by the government to start issuing storm warnings. And on the back of these storm warnings, which were, of course, sent by telegraph, I mean, this is all like kind of due to the fact that we had a telegraph which could then pass information in a flash and then relay it back and forth.
And so you get American Samuel Morse into your story, don't you?
So, yeah, that's right. That's right. The equivalent is the Cook and Wheatstone one in Britain. And Samuel Morse is obviously the great pioneer of the telegraph in America, where similar things were going on. But by the 1860s, they'd collapsed into civil war. So this is where Fitzroy then becomes really the lone pioneer of forecasting.
And Queen Victoria sends him messages asking for personal weather forecasts.
She does. She sends her footmen round to see what the weather's going to be like when she's going over to the Isle of Wight to a nice stately home, so she doesn't want to be rocked around too much. Yeah, there's a great sense of novelty, because people had weather predictions before, but they were a bit like horoscopes, you know. They were in almanacs, and they'd be derived from things like the movements of the planets and things like this. And but then all of a sudden, you've got the Times of London, which is, you know, the kind of the great establishment newspaper issuing these weather forecasts, which Fitzroy was very foolishly saying. I mean, he was saying that very soon they were going to be able to predict the weather 2 days in advance with the certainty of a solar eclipse. So he was getting a bit carried away as well. He was kind of on, I think he was on the crest of his achievements, really. And there's this period between 1861 and 1865 where this is, I suppose, the weather experiment, which gives the kind of the book its title, where Fitzroy talks about this experimental process which he's going through, which is a kind of philosophical, a social and a technological experiment at the same time, where he's trying to kind of see if people will put up with him and his predictions, because he thinks that they are going to save lives at sea. And, of course, there's lots of funny stories which accompany this. I mean, for the horse racing classes, for example, they're really good because you can measure the state of the turf and see how wet or dry it is, and then you can alter your betting on based on that. And then people can decide whether they're going to wear a hat or not and things like this. And
given that we're both cricketing nations, I suppose it was also fascinating to cricket teams.
Yeah, I looked really, really hard because I was after a cricket anecdote and I couldn't find one, which was a bit annoying. But but one I did find, which I really liked, was about a French acrobat called Blondine, who was the great acrobat of the day. And he had come over to London to walk across a tightrope, which was slung over the Crystal Palace, which is where they had the great exhibition. And and the Times had written an editorial based on this, and they said, "Now we have Admiral Fitzroy's weather forecasts, we'll know how windy it's going to be when Mr. Blondine walks across his tightrope." And they said, "If the organisers think about this sensibly, they can charge more money depending on how windy it's going to be." And I thought that was a wonderful kind of about-face for our modern health and safety kind of culture, because instead of calling it off, they thought they could charge more money. But that's, that's
was wrong. Fitzroy, I want you to tell the sad story at the end of his life in the few moments we've got left, but Fitzroy must have been a most exalted figure before things turned bad for him.
Well, Fitzroy was an outrider. He was a rebel. He, he wasn't, I suppose he'd been brought up in the Navy, and for that he like kind of always had this sense of action and duty, and he was willing to, kind of do all this forecasting. But eventually, I suppose, the criticism came when they went wrong. And
as you point out, he was shredded in the Times. He'd been the first newspaper to carry his forecast.
Yeah.
And at the end of his life, which we're now going to describe, he thought his great project had failed. So tell us what happens then to the poor man.
Well, I think he suffered from terrible black depressions, and in 1864, 1865, he's approaching his 60th birthday. He's physically weakened and he's mentally encumbered with all of this stress of predicting weather, and he takes a break, goes and takes a house outside London, and eventually commits suicide on a Sunday morning before church. So it's a sad story, and in that sense, but I think it's a story which has greater resonance today when you look back at his achievements, because a bit like an Alan Turing kind of character.
It's very much like the Alan Turing story, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Good heavens above. And after he dies, you tell us that England stopped issuing weather reports for about a decade.
They did. So from being pioneers, they went to being, I can't think of what the opposite of a pioneer is. They became very conservative in their meteorological work. And the scientists especially took it as an opportunity to, because they'd always been suspicious about Fitzroy and his practical science. And they got rid of them. The Royal Society got rid of these forecasts within a year or so.
Well, you've done him proud, Peter. You've brought him back to life. And it's a story which, like the Alan Turing one, calls out to be filmed. I guess you've got a few producers on the phone offering to pay huge amounts for the option.
Well, maybe if you keep talking about it, that won't do any harm.
Peter, I thank you very much. Peter Moore's book is called The Weather Experiment, The Pioneers Who Sought to See the Future, and it's published by Chatto and Windus. Windus is a good name for a publisher publishing a book about winds. And I think I've warned you already that there may be stormy weather, but no, I'm sure it'll be all terribly, terribly calm. It may, in fact, be a rapprochement. It may be a time when two long-standing enemies kiss and make up. Heaven knows what's going to occur. This is Len Annell on RN, and coming up, I will have social intercourse with Gerard Henderson. Well, Well, beloved Gladys and Potties, we're about to talk about one of Australia's great polemicists and polarisers in B.A. Santa Maria. And I'm going to be talking about Bob with another polemicist and polariser, my old friend Gerard Henderson. Now, it will come as a surprise to many of you that Gerard and I are sitting in a studio, and it will also come as a surprise and perhaps a disappointment that we are both going to be incredibly nice to each other because we have a job to do. Bob Santa Maria, known for his strident anti-communism during the Cold War, had an opinion on all the big moral and political issues of his time, and he made those views widely known on a weekly TV slot, Point of View. It was on Sir Frank Packer's Channel 9s, and it ran forever. I interviewed Santa in 1996, and believe it or not, we actually got on very well, but it was towards the end of his life, and there were a number of reconciliations. Mine was one, and Jim McClellan's was another. More of that later. Santa was a complicated bloke. While he railed against many of the views expressed by lefties like myself, he was also very critical of many things that lefties disliked. And young people coming to Santa Maria find this very confusing, that he was opposed to what is now known as economic rationalism, and he warned about the excesses of multinational corporations. If he was alive today, he'd be about to get his tweet from the palace because he'd be turning 100. Gerard, as it happens, has just completed a whopping, and as we're televising this, I should hold this up to the camera, this whopping book called Santa Maria, A Most Unusual Man. And Gerard, welcome. It's been a while.
It has been a while, Philip, but I've come back and I hope you like the flowers and the chocolate.
Public opinion of Santa, wide and varied. To some of us, he was a political zealot, others a role model. And paradoxically, he could be described as both an anti-communist and an anti-capitalist. How did he see himself?
Well, I think the most accurate comment he made in terms of his effect on politics, he actually made to you in that interview that you did. I think he was in Melbourne, you were in Sydney. And he said he felt that his influence had been overestimated by both his opponents and his supporters. And I think that's right. How did he see himself? Well, he saw himself, oddly enough, as a peasant. No, he wasn't a peasant. But he saw himself as a kind of a peasant born of Italian parents 100 years ago next month. He saw himself struggling against the tide. He saw himself unfashionable. Some of all of that was true. Some of it was not true, because in the end, he was a highly regarded and influential figure. As you point out, he had a Point of View program on Channel 9 on a Sunday morning. He had a weekly column in The Australian for over 20 years, so he ends up a very influential commentator. But he saw himself as someone who hadn't really been accepted by society, who was uncomfortable, in a sense, in society, but he kept on going because he believed in certain causes. Broadly, he was a fairly consistent thinker. Certainly in his anti-communism and his attitude to economics, he was pretty consistent. His attitude to social matters as well. But he always saw himself as prevailing against something, although those of us who looked at him didn't necessarily see him that way, certainly not all the time.
Let's play a grab from that interview of 1996. I asked him whether the Catholic hierarchy viewed him as a great asset or a thorn in the flesh, and this is what he said.
I believe that friend and enemy alike grossly exaggerate any influence that I might have, but if you've asked me a practical question, let me say this. I've often thought of my Requiem Mass, and I think that probably quite a number of bishops will be there.
Just to make sure you're dead, though, Paul, basically.
I hope so. I think that there will be about three who will regret it.
Well, that's three more than I'll get, so that's complain about that.
No, I think there are a lot of people in the Catholic Church who think that people with your views are the wave of the future.
Tell us about the funeral. Who did come, Joe?
Well, it was a great event. I dropped in because I happened to be in Melbourne, stayed down the back and behaved myself. Who did come? Well, virtually, as you predicted, virtually all the hierarchy, the Catholic hierarchy was there. I think more than three people regretted him going, but some, I suspect, were relieved. And then there were whole lots of figures in business and some in the trade union movement and many in the Liberal and National parties, including the Prime Minister, John Howard, who read a lesson. But very few in the Labor Party, as I recall. Barry Jones turned up and Jacinta Collins turned up because she brought her father along, but made it very clear that's why she was there. So there wasn't many people there from the Labor Party. There were very few people there from his political opponents broadly within the Catholic community, but it was a bit much, it was a bit the way you and he discussed it. It wasn't dramatically different from how you'd theorised about it.
I was going to leave this till much later in the discussion, but you did finally have a falling out with Bob. What caused it, and why do you regret that there wasn't a rapprochement?
Oh, well, the truth is that Bob Santa Maria fell out with a lot of people. Not so much people like you in the end he was very fond of, and he was comfortable with you. He ended up reconciling with Clyde Cameron. He ended up reconciling with Bernie Taft of the Communist Party and many others, Jim McClelland, of course. But if you had been close to Bob and you had disagreed with him 5 or 10%, and then you fell out, he didn't reconcile with many of those people. He was, I mean, a very talented person, but he didn't handle division well within his own organisation. So if you were sort of slightly offside, he didn't tend to reconcile with them. I did invite him to interview him for my book Australian Answers, which came out in about 1990. But
you interviewed me for that. That's
I
when
did
we used to be friends.
Well, I think one day, Philip, you never know. But if you like the chocolates and stuff, it'll go well. I did interview for that book. I asked Bob if he'd be interviewed for the book, and he declined. So, I mean, I made an approach. He said no. Look, I did criticise him occasionally in my columns, but as you know, as a columnist, we criticise a lot of people. I never made any strong personal criticisms. So they're all essentially policy based. But no, I don't regret it. I mean, these things come and go. But I have tried in the book to be fair to him.
Okay, you write that in his own words, Santa went political in the early 30s. Place us in the context of the time. What were the key issues that would have sparked his interest in the 30s?
Well, as a young boy at school, and where he went in North Melbourne and later in St. Kevin's, which was then in East Melbourne, he was concerned about the Depression, of course. So that was the formation of many of his economic views. He held views that, well, he was essentially, you'd say now he was a Keynesian at the time, and he remained essentially a Keynesian all his life. But then a bit after, well, once the Depression begins to ease, and as is now demonstrated, Australia's recovery through the Depression during Joe Lyons' prime ministership was quite good and comparable to Britain, probably better than the United States. So by the time you get to the mid-30s, Bob Santa Maria's essential concern is the Spanish Civil War. And from my point of view, I mean, look, he was never a great fan of Franco. I mean, many of his opponents said he was, but he wasn't. I can't find any positive statement that Santa Maria ever made about Franco. But he was very concerned about the plight of Catholics in the Spanish Civil War at the hands of the anarchist and the communist. And he had right to be so. He had a right to hold that position. I think his position on Spain was essentially correct. And the communists were going after the Catholics. They were killing the priests, the brothers and the nuns in Spain,
okay,
and others.
Many readers will be surprised when they come across your assertion that while Franco was a ruthless dictator, he was not a fascist.
Well, this is a view generally held by historians that he was not a fascist. He didn't align with Hitler, and he ran a pretty ruthless authoritarian regime.
Guernica comes to mind, Gerard.
Well, he didn't align. Well, I tell you what also comes to mind, Philip, because of your background in the Communist Party, you'd be aware of this. I mean, the Nazi-Soviet Pact occurred between 39 and 41, and all the communists in Australia lined up behind Hitler. Now, Santa Maria never lined up behind Franco to that extent. Now, Guernica occurred. I understand the Spanish Civil War was a dreadful civil war, and as I point out in the book, there were atrocities on both sides. But in the end, for whatever reason, Franco, unlike Stalin, did not go with Hitler. Spain remained neutral, and I quote a number of prominent historians in the book saying that the decision, including David Price Jones, who's not a Catholic, the decision of Spain to remain neutral was very important to the Allied victory. So whilst I'm no fan of Franco, he was a brutal dictator, but the alternative to Franco was probably a more brutal dictatorship.
I raised this issue with Santa in our chat, but I understand that he wrote his thesis on Mussolini.
Yes, he did.
Okay. During the interview, I asked him why he was attracted to this political figure. Have a listen.
Well, that's not exactly right. My thesis actually was not on Mussolini. My thesis was on the history of Italy between the unification of Italy in 1870 and the March on Rome in 1922. It was not an analysis of Mussolini, but an analysis of the factors that actually brought him to power. As to Mussolini himself, when I recognised, as a person with large Italian sympathies, that between the end of the war in 1918 and 1922, there had been no less than 11 Italian governments, and they'd brought Italy to the very brink of chaos, the idea that there should be a government which could restore order was attractive to me. And I was strongly in favour of that government until roughly 1936. After that, things took a turn.
Gerard and I are channeling B.A. Santa Maria on Leninil, on RN, online and on your pod. Santa Maria is well remembered by many for these, you know, for his anti-communist zealotry. Yet, in an interview he did with Robin Hughes, which I'm sure you'll recall, he said that until about 35, he'd always believed, as a consequence of the Depression, that the real problem facing society, Western society, was capitalism. What was it that remoulded his thinking?
Well, I think what remoulded his thinking to the extent to which it did, because in the end, in the final years of his life, he sort of came back to that position. He also had his book, The Earth Our Mother, would be, you know, well regarded by people who like Pope Francis's most recent encyclical. But I think what essentially changed was circumstances and the emergence of communism through the 30s into the 40s into the 50s was what essentially changed him. So that became his immediate focus. And from his position, I think that was a perfectly reasonable position to hold. What he said to you in that interview was pretty correct. His thesis isn't a very good thesis. It's not pro-Mussolini. It's sympathetic to people who are trying to form a united government in Italy. But Santa Maria was never a great supporter of Mussolini, as he was never a great supporter of Franco, and I've been through all the documents. But he did become increasingly concerned about communism, and I think he had good reason to do so.
It's interesting that you link him, at least loosely, to the current Pope. I don't think he would have viewed John 23 with much enthusiasm.
Well, he went over to the Vatican and saw him. I've got a photograph in the book of that. And look, Bob Santa Maria liked all the popes. His greatest argument really was with Pope Pius XII, who'd ruled against him at the time of the division within the Catholic Church at the time of the Labour split. But Bob Santa Maria was essentially, you know, a good Catholic servant. And in the end, he pretty well supported all the popes, although I think perhaps some of them he didn't admire as much as others. But he ended up... I never saw a criticism that he made of a pope in public.
People of the left, myself included, who regarded Bob as absolutely lethal to Labour and attribute to him the fact that we were out of power for almost forever, is the momentum seems to begin with the movement established in secret. Tell the listener, many of whom don't remember the movement.
Really?
What the hell it was?
Well, in the late 30s, early 40s, Santa Maria set up a Catholic organisation that was essentially anti-communist, and the aim was to support the anti-communist forces within the trade union movement who were represented within the Australian Labor Party. Now, the movement essentially did good work. It did good anti-communist work, and it cooperated with a lot of people like Laurie Short, who are atheists, who are anti-communists, and the iron workers and whatever. So that's essentially what he did with the movement, but he ran into disputes really after, to some extent, that they had succeeded, and then the issue was what would happen with the movement, and eventually the Sydney hierarchy, Cardinal Gilroy, Bishop Carroll, turned against Santa Maria, which led to the split in the Catholic hierarchy, which mirrored the split in the Labour Party. But so it was essentially a Catholic organisation, it was a fairly secretive organisation, it was an anti-communist organisation, and it operated in society to take on the Communist Party, which it, for the most part it did quite successfully.
And then it lived on as the National Civic Council.
Then when Rome essentially ruled, Rome essentially supported the Sydney hierarchy against the Melbourne hierarchy, and Santa Maria was the force that dropped this term, the Catholic Social Studies Movement, and in late 1957 he formed what was called the National Civic Council.
I recall the era of, yes, a lot of communist influence in the unions. I recall communist trade union leaders rather differently than you do. Many of them I found inspirational. They tended to be incorruptible, unlike many other sort of union leaders.
Yeah, but all
leaders.
Of them supported Joe Stalin in the 40s and 50s. I think that's important to remember. If I just go back on the Labour split, as I make clear in my book, Santa Maria had a role in the Labour split, which led to the creation of the Democratic Labour Party, and what you were saying, the Labour being out of power for nearly two decades. But
did Santa Maria want that?
No,
did he want to hand the control of the nation to the Liberals?
But he didn't drive it. At the time of the Labour split, when Bert Everett, the Labour leader, turned on his own Victorian state executive in October 1954, Bob Santa Maria just turned 39. He wasn't in the Labour Party. He didn't know many people in the Labour Party. Without question, and even people like Neville Rann have accepted this, without question, the split was driven by Bert Everett, the Labour leader, who, it is now broadly accepted, was mentally unbalanced for many years before the split. Everett drove the split, and the issue is how people responded to it. Santa Maria supported the breakaway Democratic Labour Party. The only communists in Sydney said they should stay in. But if Bert Everett hadn't been on the scene in 1954, on my analysis, Labour would never have split. And I think that's also the analysis of Robert Murray, who wrote that great book, The Split, nearly half a century ago now.
Let's look at his relationships, plural, with the Libs. To a casual observer, Santa and the Libs would seem to be ideological bedfellows, stridently anti-communist, socially conservative, with more than a nod to tradition. Yet Bob took pride in his claim of never having voted for the Liberals. Why didn't he like them?
Well, from the time he was at school, he never really liked the Liberals. He tended to like Liberals later in his life when they were in opposition, like Malcolm Fraser and Robert Menzies and John Howard. He never really liked the Liberal Party in government because he always felt he could do better.
It's interesting, isn't it, that when Howard visits Santa Maria on his deathbed, he's not entirely welcome.
Oh, I don't think that's correct. I mean, he wasn't entirely conscious. I think that's the point. When John Howard visited Santa Maria on his deathbed, Santa Maria was unconscious.
Let me rephrase Jim McClelland, the late Whitlam minister, said that while he found it hard to hate anybody, he made an exception of John Howard.
Yes, he said that about a year. Bob Santa Maria said that about a year before he died. If he, on his deathbed, he would have been courteous to any visitor. But he said that a year before he died. And
there is an urban myth that he didn't want to see Howard at the end.
Oh, he was unconscious. I mean, I've documented in the book. He was unconscious. I think the family wanted to see John Howard, and he wasn't conscious. But he did say that to Jim McClelland about a year before he died. But the Australian carried this story because they asked Bob Santa Maria's widow, who was his second wife, Dorothy Jensen, about this attitude. And Dorothy Jensen, who only recently died, said, well, Bob said those kind of things about all political leaders. And in a sense, that was true. I mean, as Patrick Morgan points out in that two-volume collection that he did for Melbourne University Press, he can't find anyone who was ever in office that Bob Santa Maria ever praised at all, and I can't find anyone either. In my dealings with him, which extended from 1965 to 1975, I never heard him really praise anyone. I mean, he praised Archbishop Mannix, he spoke about his own family positively, but he was forever finding fault in people. And, I mean, he did make that comment about John Howard, but he would have made that comment about so many people. I can't remember him ever saying, praising public figures. He wasn't that kind of person.
You argue, and Santa said, that although he was the progenitor of the DLP, that he didn't run it. Many of us find that hard.
Well, he didn't run it. I think he would. He had something to do with forming it, a lot to do with forming it. He had something to do with financing it, but he never controlled it, which was one of the many exasperations. So it wasn't merely towards the end that Bob couldn't get on with the Labour Party or the Liberal Party. When the DLP was very prominent, he had a lot of problems with the DLP. Some of the problems he had I understood, but some of them I didn't understand, because if you've got a political party, I mean, you can't have someone outside telling you what to do because they don't want to listen. The DLP didn't really want to listen on everything. The Catholic Church didn't want to listen on everything. The Liberal Party, the Labour Party, the whole lot.
Let's go back a little. I recall vividly, every morning I'd head off for East Q State, school with my best friend Johnny Sinclair, and we'd skip along the footpath, often hand in hand as five-year-old, six-year-old. I would turn into the state school, John would turn into the Catholic school, and then it was Belfast. We'd chant Catholic dogs stink like frogs jumping out of hollow logs, charming, to which the response was the chant, state, state, full of hate. The divisions between Catholic and Protestant in Victoria at that time were toxic. They divided politics, and they also divided the police, as you well know.
Yes,
you know, the very strong factions between the Catholics, on the one hand, looking after, making a quid out of vice and gambling, and the Protestants making it out of abortion. But the same thing applied to the Liberal Party. I can remember when there was one Liberal minister, and Phil Lynch,
yes,
for sake.
Yes.
And he was a novelty. It was astonishing that the Catholics had got one minister into a federal government.
And that's only in the mid-1970s.
But now, of course, we've got a remarkable variety of Catholics, and one of them, at least, is constantly linked to Santa Maria. Is that fair? Is Abbott an acolyte of Santa's?
To Abbott in a minute. But I grew up in Melbourne, as you know, and in a sense, people like me were driven towards the Liberal Party because after the split, the state branch of the Victorian Party wasn't a lot different from the Communist Party. I mean, it was a very far-left branch, and they didn't want Catholics. So Catholics in Melbourne at that time drifted to the Liberal Party or drifted nowhere, and eventually they came up. It was a different atmosphere whatsoever in Sydney. I think the relationship between Santa Maria and Tony Abbott has been exaggerated. Abbott didn't get where he got by doing what Bob Santa Maria told him.
Did he encourage Abbott to enter politics?
No, he didn't. He discouraged Abbott from entering politics. He actually advised him not to because he said it wasn't worth his while joining the Liberal Party, and that those documents will be in the Australian on Saturday. He actually said to Abbott, don't do it, you're wasting your time. He, at that stage, which was the early 1970s, about 1994, he was quite hostile to the Liberal Party and was hoping to set up a new party, which he often wanted to do. And in that period of 1994, he was actually, as Patrick Morgan documents in his book, and it's in my book as well, that Santa Maria tried to get together a group of people, believe it or not, to set up a new party, which was Malcolm Fraser, who hadn't been Prime Minister for 10 years, Professor Robert Mann from La Trobe University, and Dr. John Carroll, neither of whom had ever worked in mainstream politics. I mean, this is just bizarre. So that shows how exasperated Bob Santa Maria got towards the end of his life, and of course that came to nothing as well. So he wasn't fond of the Liberal Party for a long period, but every now and then he was. So he had certain, I mean, Malcolm Fraser addressed his 40th anniversary function. He was the Prime Minister. Nice thing to do. How did Bob Santa Maria reward that? Well, within a couple of years, he said he wasn't going to vote for Fraser. He was going to vote informal, which I thought wasn't particularly gracious, but he was a bit like that at times. So, look, the relationship is complicated. But
as was his personality. One aspect was that his friends and associates speak of a habit of self-deprecation, and you write his essential humility. On the other hand, of course, he smites people hip and thigh. He ridicules others. And to some extent, he did seem to encourage a cult of the personality.
I think he did encourage a cult of the personality. I mean, as the Irish joke, I mean, I'm not sure how humble he was. Some of his supporters said he was the most humble man around. You know, so I never saw great humility with Bob. He was very he was a brilliant polemicist. He was very good at running a line. I never saw great humility, but there was a certain he sort of attempted to put himself down a bit, but I never took all that seriously. Look, he was a very tough polemicist. He was a brilliant orator. He was a kind of figure that we don't see much of in Australia. He was a kind of European figure. He fitted more readily within the Western European system than he did within the Anglo-Saxon system. And he gave brilliant speeches and brilliant orations. And he was a charismatic figure. And we don't have many charismatic figures in mainstream politics.
Why did Packer, Sir Frank, give him such patronage?
Well, Sir Frank Packer essentially gave him point of view, which was a major benefit to him. Originally, Sir Frank Packer gave it to him because he was worried about Labor had gone close to winning in the election in 1961. There was an election coming up in 1963, and Packer was worried that Labor might win it. And he thought that Bob Santa Maria would be helpful because of his anti-communism
in supporting the Democratic Labor Party vote, particularly in Victoria, which was crucial in giving preferences to the Liberal Party. And many of those people, like my own parents, had come out of the Labor Party, ended up voting DLP and gave their preference to the Liberals. And this was a big shift of votes. And Packer wanted to encourage that, and Santa Maria agreed to do it. And then he asked Packer if he could stay on the Sunday morning. He starts off in evenings before the election in 1963 and stays on. So Packer gave him that. I mean, Packer never had any relationship with all with what Bob said, but he gave him point of view. And I mean, in Melbourne and Sydney, elsewhere, Santa Maria paid for it. But in Melbourne and Sydney, I think he gave him the facilities.
You met Bob at about this time in the mid-60s, didn't
yes.
you?
Yes.
Why? How? What was going on?
Well, I was at Melbourne University, and I was an anti-communist, and I had a Catholic background, and he was a very impressive figure. I mean, Bob Santa Maria was anti-communist, as I was. Oddly enough, the only two parties in the 50s and into the early 60s who were opposed to the White Australia policy was the Communist Party and the Democratic Party, Labor Party, which Bob Santa Maria had influenced through the National Civic Council. So he was against the White Australia policy. He was anti-communist. He was internationally focused. He was a brilliant polemicist and a good writer. So he's a very attractive figure.
Did you also perhaps see him as a way for you having a political career?
No, that's a myth. I never intended to have a political career, and I was interested in argument, and I still am. I haven't really changed. But, I mean, where would I have got a political career? I mean, in Victoria in the 60s, I wasn't going to get into the Liberals, and I didn't want to. I wasn't going to get in the Labor Party because they wouldn't want me, although they would have in New South Wales. And, in fact, I got offered a union job in New South Wales later on. Many of us did. And the DLP was, you know, only ever had one senator in Victoria, or maybe two at times, and there was no future there. I never developed my political opinions with a view to political reward, because if I wanted to do that, I would have gone into the Liberal Party, which I didn't do.
Yes, okay. Look, it's been fascinating, Gerard. Thank you for this.
It's an absolute pleasure, Philip.
Yeah. It's an odd thing to have us sitting together in a studio. Gerard Henderson, author, columnist with The Weekend Australian. And, in a sense, we demonstrate pluralism, don't we, at The Australian.
We both depend on Rupert Murdoch in the end.
We do, like you depended on Santa. His new book, Santa Maria, A Most Unusual Man, out now. And thank you, Melbourne University Press. Another rip snorter to add to the political library. Time to thank the team. My blessings go to producers Matt O'Neill, Stan Corry, Carl Passario, Sasha Fegan. Welcome back, Sasha. Our technical wizard, Michelle Watts. And we'll see you all next week. Gerard and I know are going to go out on the town and get sloshed together.
Great.